From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Adam Tanner has a little experience with people trying to figure out what he's up to. In the 80s, he went to communist East Germany. Not to write some exposé, he was working on a travel guide, but it didn't much matter to the East Germans. They followed him around everywhere. But Tanner says, really, they didn't learn much about him. In fact, he says, if you put the Stasi intelligence machine next to the internet, there's no comparison. Thanks to online data gathering companies today, he says, know where you live, they know about your neighbors, your TV shows, your shopping habits and hobbies, they know about your health. Tanner has written a book that explores just how pervasive data gathering has become in everyone's daily life, and his story begins in Vegas. He'll join us to tell it after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot of the time when you're talking about gathering information through electronic communication, the National Security Agency comes up, and it should, for obvious reasons. The resources of the government to collect this kind of information is pretty mind-boggling, but the journalist Adam Tanner says if you're really worried about privacy, you should be just as concerned with the private sector. Internet giants and big retailers, so-called data brokers, are mining the information on the internet, things like public documents and commercial records. And, of course, they're collecting new information all the time. Your zip code at a gas pump, the clicks you make, the purchases, the movies you pick. This data, profiles from millions and millions of people, Tanner says, has become the lifeblood of private industry. In his new book, he calls it an elixir that fuels marketing efforts to compete and expand business. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about this data gathering. His book is called What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I'd like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter as well. What do you think about the fact that businesses are constantly gathering data about you? Is it just part of the convenience of the information age? Does it make you feel vulnerable? Should governments regulate all of this collection and the use of personal data? Again, 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Adam Tanner is a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University, where he was previously a Nieman Fellow there. He is going to be in Utah next week for a discussion at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Today in the program, he's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Adam Tanner, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin with this. It's not a diversion. It's a relevant story, and it's a good one. But you tell it very early on in the book about your time in East Germany. This was back in the 80s, back when there were, of course, still two Germanys. And you were followed pretty much everywhere. And I wanted you to just talk a little bit about that, because it's interesting when we talk about the data collected today. You went back and somehow managed to get your Stasi intelligence file. It was something like 50 pages, something like that. Just start there, if you would. Tell us about that story.
So, of course, East Germany was the communist half of Germany after the division after World War II, and they were a loyal communist ally of the Soviet Union with a very efficient secret police, the Stasi. In a single day in 1988, that was just a year before the fall of the Berlin Wall 25 years ago, 10 Stasi agents followed me around over the course of the day as I toured Dresden. Now, Dresden was a great cultural capital of Germany. It's known to many people as the site of horrific firebombing in World War II. And at that time, still part of the city was in partial ruin, some of the famous monuments. But over the course of the day, these 10 guys on my case were following me surreptitiously. I didn't know that they were following me, taking photos and taking very exact notes as to what I was doing minute by minute. And so the Stasi file that was collected about me has a log that says something like 10 o'clock, he arrives at the Semper Opera, 10:47, he leaves the building, 10:49, he's looking at a map, 10:51, he's still looking at a map, he asks for directions, and so on and so on. And there is also supplementary information that they ask. So at one point, I visit a factory that was, during World War II, a slaughterhouse. And it was the slaughterhouse where Kurt Vonnegut was interned.
Right.
And it gave the title to his book, Slaughterhouse 5. I asked the guard, is this the building that was once a slaughterhouse during World War II? Just for spending 2 or 3 minutes talking to the guard, that generated a new report. And they said, go find out what the guard knows about this guy. What did they discuss? Was something conspiratorial done during this conversation? And then there's a supplementary report that's gathered. Now, I know all of this stuff because after the unification of Germany a quarter century ago, Germans opened up the Stasi files once the country was unified and made it available to people who were themselves monitored. It took me some years to get it, but it was quite interesting in the level of detail of the surface observation that they were able to gather at that time.
Surface is the point, right? Because, I mean, that's sort of why you tell that story. If you think about kind of the ridiculous resources they used to tail you, you're writing a travel, you're writing for a travel log. So it wasn't you weren't exactly working on an expose, but what did they know? I mean, and the point you make in the book was, of course, that if you really think about it, they didn't really learn that much about you.
Right. So they were very accurate in recording the addresses where I went to, how much time I spent in different places, but they really didn't fundamentally understand that much about me. So even the concept of a travel guidebook, and I was writing the Frommer's Eastern Europe and Yugoslavia guidebook on $25 a day, it was a bit alien to them. They had a system where they would pre-allocate hotels before you came into the country, and you would pay for a 3-star hotel, and they would say, the good word of the East German state says this is a good 3-star hotel. And so for you to say to them, oh, I want this 3-star or this 4-star hotel, seemed to contradict the good word of the East German state. So even the concept of writing a travel guidebook seemed odd to them. But I think the point I'm trying to make more in broadly is that even with 10 agents following me over the course of that day, which I've been able to document through my own Stasi file, it's pretty minimal information compared to what marketers can know and often do know about us all, about hundreds of millions of Americans today in the United States, because electronic data gathering is so much easier.
Yeah. In the book, you write about living in Russia for a time. This was after that experience in Eastern Europe, and how when you would return to the United States from time to time, you say you felt such freedom, how people kind of breathed easily and freely, and no one much cared or noted what you did, which seems so different from today. Like, it was not that there was ever a time of innocence, but it does seem like, man, things really have changed.
Well, yes. So I was in the 1990s, a time of great tumult in Russia, and there was still this sentiment from the Soviet era of caution and observation of what was going on. And in America, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted, and no one was going to be taking note of it in a very deliberate way. And of course, when you easily leave electronic crumbs wherever you go, things are very different today. So yeah, that era, what I'm talking about, was quite different from today.
Yeah. What got you started about this this particular subject? Was there a particular moment, a particular thing that got you thinking, there's a bigger story here?
So as a journalist, I was often looking for people on short notice. I worked for the wire service Reuters, and I had to quickly find people in the news, whether they were celebrities or ordinary people who, for whatever reason, were in the news that day or that week. And there was one particular time that highlighted this concept of the data brokers and what they knew about us all. That was sort of a moment of inspiration in terms of about finding out more. And that happened in the mid-2000s when the former U.S. President Gerald Ford died.
Right.
He had died after a long period. He'd been around for a long time. It wasn't a big surprise. But it was late in the day, California time. And the next morning, I was trying to find out something new. What angle could I add to add a little bit more to the Gerald Ford story? And I thought an interesting way to go about that would be to find Chevy Chase, the comedian and actor, who 40 years ago on the very first season of Saturday Night Live used to often begin the show pretending to be Gerald Ford, stumbling over his desk or falling downstairs, or otherwise being a very clumsy caricature of the president. If you want to find a celebrity, typically what you'll do is you'll contact an agent or a lawyer or someone who is an intermediary, and often it takes days or weeks, and if they don't have a cause to promote, it's hard to find them. But I looked in a data broker site, and I found a number that appeared belonged to his wife, and I called that number, and a woman answered, and she said, no, I'm not Mrs. Chase, but I'm Chevy Chase's daughter, and in fact, my dad's with me right now. We're on the top of a mountain, and we're skiing in Colorado. But he'll call you when he gets down. And so 30 minutes later, the phone rings. It's Chevy Chase. We have a very interesting conversation about how indeed he did meet Gerald Ford and how gracious the former president was. And then I ran my story. But that evening, the phone rang again. And Chevy Chase said, listen, I've been thinking about this. How in the world did you get my daughter's cell phone number?
Right.
And so he realized that all the barriers that a celebrity had of agents and publicists and lawyers and so on was no counter for the data brokers who gather information about us all. And I was beginning to realize at that time you could be a judge or a politician, a baseball star, a celebrity, but information is gathered about you as well as everybody else. And so that sort of piqued my curiosity. How exactly is this data gathered? Where does it come from? And what impact does it have on all of our lives?
We'll get into the details as we go, but just give us a sense. How much information is known about the average person in this country?
Well, in your introduction, you've outlined some of the things. So often they'll know where you live, who lives with you, your contact details, even if you have an unlisted number or a cell phone number that you may not have shared in ways that you are cognizant. Would go out to the general public. They may know your educational background, whether you have professional certificates, details about home purchases. And then there's a whole layer on top of these public documents, whole layer of consumer data, what you've bought, what kind of magazines you subscribe to, what kind of things you like. All this information is piled into a dossier that may have hundreds and hundreds of individual data points about you, or even thousands of data points that are gathered from many different sources.
So broadly, it seems like one of the questions that comes from the book is just how much are we willing to pay for, how much are we willing, what are the costs, I guess, of our personal privacy for convenience and for goods and services? And I guess it should be said that all of this gathering, or most of it anyway, is perfectly legal. I mean, the ethics of some of it is another thing, which we'll talk about as we go along. But when it comes right down to it, these are just sophisticated but legitimate marketing techniques. And I guess it goes to how much we're willing to, each consumer is willing to pay for convenience, for goods, for services.
That's right. I mean, of course, for decades and decades, there have been marketing lists of people who might be likely to buy certain products. So if you subscribe to Good Housekeeping, you might receive offers for similar magazines or similar kinds of products that people in those magazines might be interested in. And that was because the magazine would sell their list of subscribers. So there have been those kind of direct mail or marketing or phone telemarketing kind of opportunities. The difference today, though, is that all of these lists can be combined into a sort of master file or a master dossier about us. And so something you did long ago or an interest you had long ago is still there in the file, and it doesn't go away. Information that would have once been hidden inside of a government file cabinet, rarely seen, would now be easily accessible to anyone. And so it's a level of knowledge and insight that's unprecedented.
You point out in the book, as you just said, this concern that that marketers are going to violate our privacy or try to manipulate us isn't really new. I wanted you to talk a little bit about a book that you referred to called The Hidden Persuaders. It was written by a man by the name of Vance Packard.
So this is a book from decades ago, sort of half a century ago, in which he warns about clever marketing at the time. Advertising in particular had greater insights into the human mind and what motivated us as consumers and shoppers, and expressed the sort of concern that somehow by having these insights, they would manipulate us in ways that would be detrimental to us. And in retrospect, it looks like a bit of an exaggeration that so much terrible would happen from it. And I think What I'm trying to do in the book is tell stories of who collects the data, how do they do it, and what impact does it have? And I'm not trying to say this is all terrible. There are many great things and advances that have come from the internet era that make our lives easier and wonderful in many regards. But at the same time, there are side effects that I think are worth considering. And they're similar to issues that we've had in past decades where you have the automobile, it's a great transportation device, but then you have to start worrying about safety issues and you have seatbelts and you have airbags and other measures. A lot of the laws we have about data today are written in previous years before we had such extensive data collection. And so some countries have more extensive protections for privacy and for data than the United States. And so it's worth thinking about, do we have ample protection for the things that we care about?
You spoke with a man named Lester Wunderman. He had given this really, I have to say, kind of fascinating speech. This was back in, I think it was 1967 or 68, and you quote some of it in the book. And you found him. He's still around. He's, I think when you talked to him not so long ago, he was 93 years old. Talk a little bit about Lester Wunderman, because and what he thought about the way marketers are trying to use personal information today, I mean, compared to the 50 years ago when he was thinking about it.
So Lester Wunderman comes from the Mad Men era of Madison Avenue advertising, and he's often considered the father of direct marketing, specifically sending you offers because you are potentially interested in this product. In 1967, he gave a speech at MIT where he outlined the future world, and he said, imagine if you could know as much about 200 million consumers as the corner grocer once knew about his handful of consumers, and you would know what kind of exact foods they like, whether they had children, all these details. You would know whether they like Bach or the Beatles. It seemed like this fantastic world, almost impossible that someone could know so much about so many different people. But the vision that he spelled out in 1967 has indeed come to pass. That is what we have today. And as you mentioned, Lester Wunderman is still alive. He says there are some aspects about all of this that can be worrying. And he said things such as dating sites, because within certain contexts, you're willing to share more information than you would in others. And you might be more vulnerable in your interest in landing a date and share things that you might not want to be otherwise circulating in that context. So there's applications that of the data that are sensitive in ways that maybe he didn't originally think about. Largely, he said there were abuses in the past as well. He's not wildly concerned, but he's concerned about certain sensitive areas that, in terms of the sharing of this personal data.
Adam Tanner is with us. His book is called What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. He's going to be in Salt Lake City next week, next Thursday. It's October 2nd. He's having a discussion at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. You can get more details about that by going to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll talk about Vegas, how Vegas comes into this story when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to give you a sense of just how much companies know about you, not just your spending habits and your telephone number, but also your past, your arrest record, your health history. Our guest is the journalist Adam Tanner, who says, in some ways, the greatest threat to privacy isn't the NSA, it's business. The information you're innocently tapping into a website, even the really obscure stuff, is getting aggregated and in some cases shared. Tanner says it's become the lifeblood of private industry. His book is called What Stays in Vegas, and he's going to be here next week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. In the meantime, you can join us if you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So let's talk about how Las Vegas comes into the picture. You begin with Old Vegas, which you visited at a time when you'd been living in Russia. This was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Describe Russia in those days as pretty grim, pretty gray. And then you took a trip to Vegas and It's a pretty big contrast, I guess. This was in the early 1990s, before the internet revolution. And in those days, you write about how, for the most part, casinos weren't really asking for your name. They weren't interested in any other kind of information. You put your money on the table, and they accepted it, no questions asked. But things are very different now. And I guess it's fair to say, Adam Tanner, Vegas, in some ways anyway, pioneered this collection of personal data.
Well, they're one of the pioneers. There's things such as the airline loyalty programs, which were started in 1981 by American Airlines and shortly followed by others in all sorts of different fields. Those were some of the pioneers in gathering customer data in exchange for something. So you'd volunteer your information for the airline miles or the promise of spending a night for free at the hotel or whatever. And the casinos have picked up on that in a very sophisticated way. In the old-style casinos, there was always a lot of freebies that could potentially be had, a trip to the buffet, a ticket to the show in the evening, maybe a free room. But it was more instinctual. It was based on the observations or notes of the staff. It wasn't scientifically measured. And in some cases, the managers would wander around, chat with the clients, and just discern that, oh, this guy seems to have good spending potential. Let's help him out by giving him a room. The changes really happened in the 1990s when they could start monitoring very closely exact spending, particularly for slot machines, which are the big money makers in Las Vegas. And what they did, in essence, was they put brains onto each individual slot machine so that they could measure who was sitting there, how long they were playing, what kind of luck that they were having, and all sorts of other details based on their playing. And that all works because you put into the machine a card, your loyalty card, and it measures everything about what you do. And then you share that card in all sorts of other spaces in casinos, and they know everything you do in the public space.
This was pioneered by a man named, and he's a crucial character in the book. And we should say, really, the book is a collection. It tells this broad story, but through the, in a lot of cases, these personal explorations of a lot of these people. And one of them is this man named Gary Loveman, who... I mean, I guess you'd think, if you think about how his involvement in Vegas and in the gambling industry, casinos, that he'd be some kind of mobster or a gambler himself, but he wasn't. I mean, he was an academic, a man you describe who preferred the exactitude of math and data to the odds in gambling. Tell us about Gary Loveman.
So as you say, he is very different from the earlier generation of casino bosses, and if you think of people like Lefty Rosenthal, who Robert De Niro played in the movie Casino, or Bugsy Siegel, those were very different characters. Gary Loveman is someone who got a PhD at MIT, and then he was a professor at Harvard Business School. At that time, in the 1990s, he began doing some consulting work for Harrah's, and that was the chain that later became Caesars, which is the largest casino company in the world today. And his academic work was largely around the concept of lifetime value of customers. And that shows that if you go and buy something today, take a slice of pizza, you're only worth a dollar or two to the pizzeria, not very much. But if you would go to the same place over and over again, over the years and over a lifetime, you might be worth $7,000 or $8,000 to the place. And the same would be true for a car company. Instead of buying a $10,000 or $20,000 car, you might be worth many hundreds of thousands, and so on.
So the idea is to see it over the long haul. That was the insight.
See it over the long haul. The problem the casinos had traditionally was that players were what they called promiscuous. They would go from one casino to the other without showing much loyalty. And the reason for that was the games were largely the same. And so one place might specialize in one kind of ambiance or atmosphere or kinds of shows, and then you'd go somewhere else. But bringing the loyalty programs big time into the casinos gave you an incentive to put all of your gambling in one place because you would get more perks and rewards, the same way the airlines have done it, that you might want to consolidate your flying with one airline to move up and become a gold or a platinum member, or to get special perks and free early boarding or free baggage and so on. So that's the concept that he brought to casinos very successfully and helping make the company the biggest in the world in terms of casinos. He left Harvard Business School. He became the chief marketing officer. Then he became and is now still the CEO of the company.
There's a story you tell, kind of this eureka moment that he has in an elevator back in the early 2000s, where data disproves instinct. And that seems an important part of the story. Would you tell that?
So there was thinking that people could tell which slot machines were more generous or looser than other slot machines. He was riding in the elevator one day at Harrah's, which is a casino on the main strip in Las Vegas. He overheard an elderly couple complaining amongst themselves and saying, "I hate Las Vegas. This place is terrible." And he inquired, "Well, what exactly is going on? Why are you so unhappy?" And they said that they were from New Jersey. They frequently gambled in Atlantic City, and they had much better luck at slot machines in Atlantic City. Now, Gary Loveman knew that, in fact, the slot machines were less generous. You were less likely to win in Atlantic City than in Las Vegas based on how they had set the odds on the machines. So that got him thinking, maybe people really cannot tell the difference. And so he did some mathematical experiments, and he found that a modern slot machine has a cycle of millions of spins. So the odds are extended over that whole period of time. And he then put two sets of machines on the floor in Las Vegas, one that was less generous, where you were more likely to lose money, and one that was more generous, where you should have a little bit more money in your pocket at the end of your play. And he found that no one could tell the difference between these two sets of machines. So what he did in turn, using that data, was he made all of his machines a little bit less generous. In other words, the casino was keeping more of your money that you were putting into the slot machines. And over time, he says that he's probably made hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even $1 billion in added revenue because of that insight. Mm.
So, of course, Caesars and started collecting this personal data, which became an important currency for them, of course. They got into data analytics. And if you're a business, you can do it like Loveman did for so long. They just did it themselves, but, you know, collect, aggregate your own consumer data. But there's also an industry of people who do this for you. These are called data brokers, and this is an important part of the book as well. Talk a little bit about some of these. Some of these are massive companies.
So data companies are entities which gather a lot of information about hundreds of millions of people and sell that information to marketers and to companies. Now, they may start with public records and then add on consumer records, licenses, other things that give insights into who you are, and they sell them to companies. Now, as you mentioned, traditionally, the casinos gathered the information themselves because the most important information about gamblers is what they do in a casino. And so the data brokers didn't have insights in those departments. But over the years, it's become more interesting for casinos as dining and entertainment and other factors became more important to the bottom line of how they're making money. The interesting thing about the data brokers is that these are companies that are largely unknown to the general public, companies such as Axiom or Experian or Epsilon, very important to the functioning of marketing, but largely unseen and unknown by the general public.
Did you get a sense of how these private data miners compare to the government? I mean, the book is not about the NSA, obviously, but in terms of facility or capacity to gather personal information, do you have a sense of where they might stack up against a massive operation like the NSA?
So the difference is that there's no incentive for the NSA to have extensive ongoing dossiers about everyone all the time.
Right.
They have great potential to gather information about key suspects, and they do for key suspects. But they don't have this active, always gathered file about all these likes and dislikes and so on about everybody. But there is an incentive in the commercial sector to do that because you want to market to people to give them things that are that they're likely to be interested in and likely to buy. And so that's the contrast. It's, you know, of course, the government is extremely sophisticated, but they're not doing the same thing. And so the sophistication of data brokers has grown greatly in recent decades to the point where there's extensive information about everybody.
Do you have a sense, Adam Tanner, what would be the smallest amount of information that you would need to really build, to really find someone or find something about someone? It doesn't take much, it seems.
So little bits of information can be very revealing in ways that are surprising. So if you just knew that someone, you might know the size of their clothing from a purchase they made. You might know that they buy an extensive big package of cable television. You might know one or two other pieces of information that could suggest that that's a person who spends a lot of time, overweight person who spends a lot of time on their couch watching television. And that could have implications for other things if that data is used improperly. There's a chapter in the book, In What Stays in Vegas, in which I go looking for a woman based on a single thumbnail-sized photo that I found on a web page. There was a company, in fact, a people search site that you could look up people that was very quiet about their own management and who was behind the company.
This was called Instant Checkmate.
Instant Checkmate.
It's like a strange company in some ways. But
but they advertise widely on Google. They've been very successful in marketing themselves to become a leader in that business where you can look up the criminal records and the public records on people.
On people you wanted to date, potentially.
It could be. It started out as check your mate, Instant Checkmate. But then you could use it for different kinds of purposes as well. And the person who was always speaking in the ads for the company or speaking in blog posts and speaking in public relations releases was someone called Kristen Bright. Right. And I began to suspect that maybe this isn't a real person because when I called or tried to reach her, there was no clues about her actually existing. And so there was a page on the internet where a Yelp page where it said, I am Kristen B. from Instant Checkmate, and it had a woman's photo. So this was an experiment to see, well, could I find this person? And if it wasn't someone working for the company, what was her story behind it? How much could I find out about her? And this in turn leads to a whole chapter. It was very interesting. That photo led to a group of other photos, and she had a false surname in the other pages that I was able to find. Some of the images showed her in bikinis. Mm-hmm. There were some innocent family photos, but there were also some erotic photos where she was topless or in provocative poses. But again, homemade stuff. So I was curious as to what was behind it. To sort of cut the story short, eventually I did find her, and it revealed a very interesting story about her dabbling with her husband in a bit of naughty internet erotica.
Right.
But her photo was just kind of expropriated from the internet and stuck onto this page. The company said that they weren't aware of who put up the page and said they had nothing to do with that, but they later did admit that Kristen Bright was not a real person and that it was just a corporate creation.
Well, the message from that, too, is that, I mean, this was information that this so-called Kristen Bright character, this photo she had put on the internet in the days before you figured when you put something on the internet, it stays on the internet. I mean, it was a kind of naive period, it seems like, for her. And I guess the lesson from that story is that, look, if it's out there, it's out there, and it's going to stay out there.
Exactly. I mean, she and her husband had started putting photos before Facebook on the internet, and they started to attract a small crowd of followers who found her to be an attractive woman, and they liked that aspect of it and posted more photos. And that's sort of the background of the story. I'm telling you the G-rated version of it in the book. There's an R-rated version.
That's right.
But the point was just with that, and even though she had hidden her real surname, there were enough clues to figure out a great deal about her and her family and then tell this elaborate story that I tell in the book. And they were quite surprised. The husband said, back in the old days when you put something on the internet, you could remain anonymous. Now you put up a photo and you get some guy from Harvard calling you up on his cell phone. So they you know, it's these little clues can be quite revealing. And it's parallel perhaps to a mosaic. If you have a single stone in a mosaic, it's hard to tell what the picture is about. But you put in a few more stones and eventually you get clues to the picture and then you can put it back together. You have a clearer insight in it. Or if you think about Wheel of Fortune, as you put a few letters there, you turn over one or two more, eventually, even with a lot of blank spots, you'll be able to figure out the bigger message.
One of the people you profile in the book or mention anyway is LaTanya Sweeney, a Harvard professor. And she has this, it's not really a parlor trick, but she does this thing where I think all she needs is, a zip code and a social security. Well, anyway, she can find out remarkable things with not much information.
So perhaps she's best known for these three pieces of data that you need to find anyone, in essence. So if you have a zip code, date of birth and gender, you can find 87% of the U.S. population. Now, she used that to look at hospital exit records in the state of Massachusetts, And the exit records did not have the name. They did not have the exact address. They had they were partially anonymized. They were trying to be cleaned up so that they could release to researchers this information. But she was able to re-identify people and find the man who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, William Weld. So it's just an example that even stuff that was once secure or seemingly impossible to break as a code is now much easier because you have multiple different data sets. And so she matched that hospital exit data with voter roll data. And between those two pieces of information, she was then able to identify people.
Adam Tanner is with us, a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. We're talking about his new book, What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. It's going to be in Utah next week. It'll be at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah on Thursday. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take some of your calls and questions when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is that number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Adam Tanner. We're talking about his new book, What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Tanner will be in Utah next week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's a question from Alex, who writes from Salt Lake City. What's the worst-case scenario? Is the data concentrated enough that an executive or an employee at one of these data companies could actually use this information to manipulate or control citizens or governments or smaller companies?
So, firstly, I should mention that in the overwhelming majority of cases, marketers are using this to try to sell you something. So, you know, there's a lot of good people in those industries working to try to, you know, advance commerce. But some of the information is sensitive. And if you think about categories such as religion or race or medical conditions, political profiles, and so on, those are categories that could be more sensitive. Now, a good marketer will not advance things in ways that's offensive because that will be counterproductive. But we were talking just a moment ago about re-identifying medical data. And if you think about how foreign hackers have gone into the accounts of big companies such as Target or Home Depot, you can imagine what would happen if that was referring to our medical records. And if a senator would get up in the Congress and condemn a foreign country for whatever they're doing, and then hackers the next day would release that medical information or try to reveal compromising information. So again, the legitimate marketers would stay far away from those kind of uses, the worst case scenario, but there could be instances that would be highly embarrassing. Now, there are certainly marketers that actively use or offer for sale lists that people would think are quite sensitive. So, for example, there are lists of 2 million American men who suffer from erectile dysfunction, and then there are lists of all sorts of other medical ailments that people may have. And that's a list that has a name, address, phone number, perhaps an email address that you can buy and market to directly. There are lists of women who have bought pornography or devices, sexual devices, in recent months. There are lists of gay high school students. So all of these things are potentially much more sensitive and could be used in ways that would be embarrassing or unwelcome. Hmm.
You mentioned how data brokers collect information from us by really getting a sense of the electronic clues that we leave behind. And you've got a chapter in your book that sort of explores how Facebook gathers information from friends. Talk a little bit about that. When we say like to something on a Facebook page, what are we telling people about ourselves?
So often you may reveal more on a social network such as Facebook than you really realize by what you're doing. So there have been studies that show, for example, who your friends are may indicate what your sexual proclivity is. So if you don't say anything about whether you like men or women, if you have more than a certain percentage of gay friends, it may suggest that you, according to the statistical odds and patterns of other people, that you are likely gay. And the same is true for likes. Likes are one of the most public features of Facebook that have traditionally been very visible to anyone. But based on who you like in terms of celebrities and various other things, it may give information about your preferences, including sexual preference. So that may not be something that you intended to reveal, but the pattern of data shows that you're likely in that category.
You write about the fact that there is a darker side. Some of these companies are making money off of, as you put it, the misery of certain people. You say that something that I think a lot of people will understand, shaming has never been more profitable or easy. And there's a section in the book that talks about this mugshot website. And one of the people behind this, a man by the name of Kyle Prawl. You found him in Texas. Tell us the story about Kyle Prawl.
So Kyle Prawl is the son of a judge who in high school was a rather restless youth. And he became his high school drug dealer. He had some various scrapes with the law and himself was arrested 6 times. He was a quite smart guy, remains a smart guy, but was always a bit bored by conventional finance and business. And so he eventually started his own business that would gather mugshots that are taken when people are arrested. And firstly, he sold them in a magazine in Austin, Texas. Then he put photos on the internet and then expanded across the nation. And the way it had been working was that when you looked up someone's name, often in a search on the internet, that photo, that mugshot would come up prominently. And if you were that person and you were alarmed to see that your mugshot had been revealed in such a public way, you could click on it and it would say, oh, for a courtesy fee, perhaps $100, we'll remove this photo for you.
Yeah.
Now, that was the business model. There's some competitors. They've since changed the practice and are trying to cast themselves as someone who are sharing public information for the public.
Yeah.
But it's a way that has caused a lot of angst amongst people who are impacted.
Well, I mean, it's certainly questionable ethically. And you find these kinds of ethical boundary lines. It seems like you must have found a lot of this in the sites and the information gathering that you were exploring.
I mean, there are other variants of it. For example, there's a site called My Ex, and its slogan is Get Revenge. And what it encourages people to do is publish photos that are compromising in some ways. It may be a naked person or something that would be embarrassing. And that when your ex has done that to you, you can then click on the site, and for $500, they'll remove that image. There are other sites that profit by just letting people say whatever they want about anyone. There was just a woman who came to a talk I was giving yesterday in San Francisco who had the most scurrilous and outrageous stuff said about her that caused her to go into deep slump and deep depression for a while. Just because for an ordinary person, if you have something like that written about you, it will be easily found by others. And then the site may be making money for advertising or through other means. So there's certainly this darker side that you mentioned, although it doesn't impact everyone. It's out there.
Right. You write about that as businesses keep you know, moving this line, keep going up to, it seems like, the boundary of invading someone's privacy potentially, that social norms will evolve. And you say some things that once seemed, you know, creepy or invasive may come to be seen as kind of just the way it is. Talk a little bit about changing norms, because this seems like something you're thinking about or maybe even worried about.
Well, I think norms will change in both ways. Things will become more public that people will be easy about releasing, and other things will become perhaps go back a little bit over time. Now, you think even something as innocent as a photograph, you could now often find photographs about almost anybody. There was a point in time where it was hard to find photographs about people, but now many people are very comfortable in sharing all sorts of aspects of their lives photographically. And then details about some people share details about medical conditions and things like that. But I think there's going to be, as people realize the potential impact of wide-scale sharing and what the negative downside may be, there may be areas that people become more protective of over time. So I think it's a two-way street that could happen.
You do say that everyone should really reflect on the issue of personal data, and you say we need to decide for ourselves where our line is, I guess.
Exactly. So I'm not prescribing that, you know, take all these measures, you know, take the hatch and close it all down. Mm-hmm. I think you should understand that there are these very sophisticated means of businesses gathering information about you, and then you should decide for yourself, am I comfortable sharing with this business this information? Some businesses are open about what they do with the data. So the casino example we talked about before, casinos do not share their data beyond their company walls. So that data does actually stay in Vegas. So if you're comfortable with that, you can join their program. If you don't want to, you don't join their program. A lot of companies aren't very clear. Their privacy policies are quite obscure, and they're not doing a good job. So I think companies can do a lot more to tell us, do they sell their data or rent it to other people? Do they gather data about us in addition to what we buy on their site from data brokers? I think transparency on those fronts will make us more confident in doing business with certain merchants. So I think there should be a greater awareness amongst we, the consumers, greater openness of the companies, and then choice so that the customers for themselves can decide what they want to do.
Because you do point out that consumers shouldn't just take all of this for granted or just passively accept this kind of stuff. I guess that's the point, though, is the question of being transparent. That's what you're hoping for more than anything, as opposed to, as you say, closing down the hatch. As long as people are open, then people can decide where their line is, I guess.
That's right. So much of my narrative of the book is about Las Vegas, a traditionally closed world. Caesars has been open with me to kind of crack open the door so I can see the inner workings and tell that story in the narrative. There's also an appendix in the book that talks about means you can take to boost your privacy. And to be honest, it does take more effort to be conscious and boost your privacy in certain realms.
Yeah.
But there may be certain things that you're more concerned about and then other things you're not concerned about. So you take this instance a few weeks back of the celebrity photos that were released, Jennifer Lawrence and others, from their cloud accounts. Now, there are better encrypted sites where you encrypt the photos or the documents before you send them to the cloud. They're more of a pain to use, and I've used many of these different sites. But it may be that you have certain documents, medical or tax forms or other things, that you want to be better protected, and then much of the stuff you don't care about, and you would take the lesser means of security. Mm. So I think that may be a policy that works for people, so their most valuable stuff is more secure.
Well, there are ways to... Well, it might be impossible to get off the grid so-called entirely. You do mention, for example, a professor from Columbia Law School who is really careful, maintains his own web server. He doesn't use a smartphone. He encrypts all of his communications. But it seems like a lot of work. Is that what it would take if you wanted to really limit people's access to your information?
That is a sort of more extreme case because, firstly, most people don't have that extreme technical sophistication that takes to do that. But I think just using more common sense in sharing information. Just yesterday, a company that I was trying to buy on the internet something worth $50, they asked me to verify my identity by sending a copy of my passport or my driver's license.
Wow!
And I was thinking, that's too much. For a $50 purchase on my credit card, for them to verify my identity, I understand they're trying to protect against credit card, but it's not a step that I'm willing to take right now for that product, and I declined the sale. So, you know, it may be just simpler instances like that where if they're asking too much from you, you'll say no, or you'll take a little bit of effort to try to find out, do they share the data? Or if it's a sensitive product, you might just walk into the store and pay cash, and then no one will know about it.
One scholar you talked to mentioned that, and I want to quote this because I thought it was interesting, because one of the things you write about are these privacy-enhancing tools that can help increase your online anonymity. But this professor said that after a certain point, the marginal costs of trying to protect more and more of your personal information increases rapidly, while the effectiveness of those strategies decrease equally as rapidly. So there are some strategies, but... I guess at some point the question is how effective are they going to really be when you think about the exponential growth of this information gathering.
That's true. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that a lot of these sites that we love are for free. And so you love Facebook, it's free. And what they're doing is gathering your data to market to you in a very sophisticated, targeted manner. So you have to think about services that are free are trying to get something in return. They're trying to make money by leveraging your data. So think about that. And there may be other ways to share other services that you could use that may be more expensive, but use less of your data. So it's a choice that we all have to make as consumers.
One of our previous callers asked the question whether or not in the future you think corporations are going to have greater control and use of our data, or if you figure some control might at some point be returned to the public where we could gain more control of it. Or has that train left the station, do you think, at this point?
Well, I mean, you have other countries where there are more laws and protections. So the European Union is one better example, where it's more of a model where you can opt in to be on various lists rather than opt out of lists that they've already gathered about you. So that's one model in certain areas that you may want to know about. I mean, one area that I'm now exploring more is medical data. Much of our medical data is sold on an anonymous basis when we go to the pharmacy or have blood tests or go to hospitals and check out and so on. Largely, this is unknown to the public, but it's a big multi-billion dollar business. So the question is, are those safeguards enough? What should the public know about them? So I think over time, there may be more legislative looks at these things to try to help establish a balance so that business can go ahead and market to us in ways that's sophisticated and helps consumers and helps the business, but also gives we, the consumers, a choice in what we're sharing.
Yeah. We're pretty much out of time. I guess one of the other options is, of course, and you point this out in your book, go into a place and pay in cash. It seems so quaint, but there you go. No one really needs to know much beyond the fact that you gave cash, I guess.
So if it's a sensitive purchase, that may be a wise strategy.
Yeah. Adam Tanner is a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is called What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. He'll be here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah next Thursday. You can get the details for that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Adam Tanner, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical director for the program is Mike Anderson. Our intern is Michael Shea. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.